The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
And now we step into Agribusiness Innovations with Mr. Jody White. Good morning.
Good morning, Tosca. Trinidad and Tobago, thanks for joining us on another episode of Agribusiness Innovation. Of course, we are live every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. Today's show, we're going to be talking about water. We're going to be talking about how it relates to food security and some other things related. We do have an interview within a couple of weeks from a European company. There is a solution that's implemented in many countries around the world where they use spherical bowls and put them at the top of reservoirs to prevent evaporation. And one of the companies that's responsible for doing that, based out of Europe, will be doing an interview with us very, very soon. So I want to say stay tuned for that. Now, just a bit of a fun fact, because I know we did some fun facts last week. When we think about innovation and agriculture, bread does not really come to mind. So I'm going to give you some quick facts on bread before we get into the meat of our interview today. Because when it comes to Trinidad, if somebody says bread, most of us immediately picture a sandwich bread. That's what we've grown up on. It's soft, it's sliced, and you get it in a plastic bag. And, you know, we think about cheese paste, we think about sardine, ham, peanut butter, and bread is convenience here. It's what we use for school lunches. It's recovery food. But then when you start to travel, bread takes on a totally different dimension. And you go to France, and bread suddenly becomes an event with people walking home with giant baguettes sticking out of their bags. It's a very, very hard bread. And if it hits somebody with it, you know, you might count it as assault. But they are proud of what they call bread. And then Italy has another version, focaccia, and that is a thick, fluffy bread with olive oil and herbs. And it's somewhere between bread and what they would say is an emotional experience. But then if you go to India, it is something different. Naan. And bread is now living on the side of a tandoor oven. It's bubbling up with butter and garlic. And you don't really slice that and put tuna in it. It's a totally different dynamic. Middle Eastern countries, you may look at bread, and bread is actually a pita. It's like a utensil. It's what you use to kind of pick up food, or you stuff it. It's kind of like a part spoon, part plate, part transport system for hummus. Africa has things like flatbreads, and fermented breads are staples, different textures. Ethiopia has something called injera, which is, you know, it's like a giant edible sponge, but somehow it looks perfectly. If you've ever been to an Ethiopian restaurant, they would give you your food in a big plate with this injera, and then all the items or what we'd consider the curries are put on it, and you all share this and dip into it communally. So it is something else. So if you've ever got the chance to travel, you would start to appreciate the differences. And it's just our fun fact for today. So jumping into today's interview, we have Dr. Ronald Rupnarine joining us. Doc, thanks for coming in.
Hi, good morning, and good morning to you and all your listeners as well. Pleasure to be here.
So Dr. Ronald Rupnarine, he's very, very well versed. I'm going to read some facts about Doc. He has a thorough background in environmental and agricultural management, geographical information systems, climate change adaptation and resilience, disaster risk management, sustainable development, integrated water resource management and soil mechanics, international and regional academic and management experience, and he's a former senior lecturer in earth science at COSTAT and adjunct lecturer in the Facility of Food and Agriculture, University of the West Indies. He's currently a lecturer in disaster risk resilience in agriculture and the environment in the Department of Food Production. He's a network manager at Caribbean WaterNet, CapNet UNDP, and a regional environmental disaster risk management consultant. So, of course, Doc, when we have the upcoming programs with all guests from around the world, I hope you'll be happy to join us, because it's really right up your alley.
Sure, man. Once time permits, I'll be here.
Great. So jumping into today's interview, your work covers disaster risk, water resources, and sustainable development, as we mentioned. And most people would not immediately connect those three things to what ends up on their dinner plate. How do you make that connection?
Right. So I think generally, right, persons view things in silos, and once something is not directly in front of you, you hardly ever make the connections. But food security in general and something growing in the ground depends on a lot of climatic factors, which brings in the whole water resources aspect. So food security depends on stable water resources, for instance, a healthy ecosystem. You need fertile soil, etc. Also, you need functioning infrastructure, because that's one of the major challenges in the Caribbean region. Our agriculture is so, I guess, ad hoc, in a sense that you don't really have established agricultural zones. So to get, you know, water and even access roads and so on tends to become a challenge, right? And you also, of course, depend on the normal weather. So you have like heat, you have the temperature, you have all these different factors that influence how your crops grow, and not just crops, your livestock as well. At the same time, when you take all of these things together, what that means is that any change or any alteration or any extreme that happens impacts the outcome, which is what, as we are discussing today, I guess, food security and agricultural productivity. So a simple example is, if you don't have enough water, you're going to have problems. If the quality of the water is not good, you're also going to have problems. If your soil is not fertile, you're going to have problems. If they lack certain nutrients and so on, you're going to have problems. Yeah, so essentially, all these things are linked. You have to have a healthy ecosystem to ensure that you're able to maximize your productivity. And Trinidad is a very complex place when it comes to our soils. Our soils are very, very diverse. So one farmer may have, you know, a couple acres of land, and on that plot of land, you may have multiple different soil types. So while you may be watering consistently at a uniform rate across your entire field, it does not necessarily translate into the same water content across all the gamut of the field itself, because the soils may be different. They may have different water holding capacity. Some may be a little more clay than others. The layers, in terms of the profile of the soils, there may be differences as well. So it becomes a sort of a management nightmare when you are trying to ensure some level of consistency.
That is always a challenge. And a lot of people within the agriculture sector right now would say that we don't have adequate infrastructure for our goals. One of the simplest things is telling farmers that you're not allowed to use sprinklers and hoses at certain times of the year. It is not practical for a farmer to walk around with a spray can and water every single item. And there are technologies that would do a lot more improved ways of irrigating a field. But practicality of farmers being able to afford some of those systems here, and we've had some of those guests on the program. Some of you might recall we had a guest come in from Vancouver who had a system where satellites would fly over and monitor your fields and specifically water specific plants or specific parts of the field automatically. Verde Farms, I believe, was the name. You know, so I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect, and it is still a challenge, and it is something that's still not fully addressed. Farmers within particular areas would just what we call take a chance, where if there is a ban, they would still take a chance and turn on the sprinklers, even though they're not allowed to. So, I mean, these are all some of the challenges that we faced. Now, Doc, kind of moving on from there, we spend billions importing food every single year. But from a sustainable development perspective, is that simply an economic choice, or does it represent a deeper vulnerability that we are not taking seriously enough?
Well, before I get to that, I just had one more thing to say about the infrastructure and the sustainable development water resources connection, right? I think it is also important for us to understand that as a country, we need to look at agriculture in a more serious manner. and ensure that there's some level of support, not just, you know, grants and flood relief and that sort of thing, and ad hoc little programs that occur occasionally. It should be something that is formalized in a manner where farmers can actually be considered, you know, full employees of the government. I actually feel like, you know, farmers could be treated like teachers with a monthly salary and provided with all the resources that they require, and they simply just produce a certain amount of goods. Because this may sound a little bit strange, but if you ask anybody in Trinidad or any farmer or anything, or even if you look at national data and you ask, like, how much tomatoes do we produce every year or every 3 months or whatever, nobody could actually give you a correct answer, because there is so much informality in how this sector is structured. And while we speak about developing agriculture, a lot of it is just old talk. Yeah, so I just wanted to share that thought. Yeah?
That is true. When we're trying to make decisions, it's usually done nationally in a manner that would please the population. Especially for me in the sector that I operate in. I operated in largely the root crop sector. And some of the things I would consistently hear being said would be, we need more cassava flour, we need more cassava flour. And I am very sure it is being said by people in positions who have never even tried to use cassava flour. And that they don't understand what are the uses, the limitations, the benefits. It's nice to say it, but if you don't have experience in it, some of these things are never actually going to bring results. So I fully agree with you there.
Yeah, and it has happened before. I mean, we have tried cassava flour. We remember there was a time, I think it was during the Taba time, when they introduced sweet potato fries into KFC and so on, and it lasted for a while, and then it just faded away. So I guess let me move on to your next question, which was about the food importation, right?
Yes.
I think yes. The short answer is yes. It places us in a position of deeper vulnerability. And I think that was very clear during COVID. Trinidad and Tobago is obviously vulnerable to global supply chain issues, because obviously if you import and there's any sort of global incident that affects shipping routes and so on, you're going to be affected. And it's not just the importation of the crops and the food items itself. It's also the importation of inputs like fertilizer and so on, right? There will also be, I mean, given even currently when you see the little issue with the Strait of Hormuz and et cetera affecting global shipping, there could be rising costs that will obviously be translated onto the consumers in many cases. And then international price volatility means that you have very limited access over the, not access, but control over the cost. And that is a problem. In addition to that, when you import so much, right, the limited forex that you do have is actually spent on that. And I will say something that is probably a little bit controversial. We talk about reducing imports, but I always say that there are people who benefit from the fact that we import so much. And that is one of the major concerns, because there are persons or sectors of society that heavily depend on importation for a variety of reasons. And the issue is not necessarily eliminating imports entirely. I mean, that's unrealistic. But improving strategic local production, and in my opinion, not just production for us to consume locally, but also to try to export, because you can gain forex from some of the unique products that we produce in Trinidad and the Caribbean as a whole. So food security should be viewed as part of, you know, both national security and economic resilience. I hope that answers your question.
You know, it does. I want to take a step back into something, because we say certain terms, certain things sound pretty, but it may not be as easy to define by the common man. Sustainable agriculture. When we say develop the sector sustainably, what exactly we really mean?
Well, sustainability is all about, I mean, in the broad sense of the term, what sustainability really means, as you know, we have the development goals, and it has been a topic that has been, I guess, in the forefront for quite some time, right? And what it really means is ensuring intergenerational equity and doing things in a manner that you could continue to do it in that manner for a long period of time without causing any sort of adverse impacts, right? So in terms of agriculture, what does that mean? It means that you have to develop a system that looks at and balancing things like, you know, water and soil resources. So like whatever techniques you're using, you're not causing any harm to the soil. You're not causing any harm to water resources. You're also not resulting, your activities is not resulting in any sort of significant environmental degradation. You also want to look at, you know, different practices like integrated pest management. What that really means is not heavily depending on chemicals, because many times, you know, people talk about using organic products and so on. But if you speak to many farmers, and you may know as well, some of these things are just not as effective to a farmer as if you utilize the conventional chemicals. And what they are concerned about is ensuring that their productivity is maintained. So many times people shy away from the organic approach because it is simply not as effective. And I mean, as much as we want to promote things like that from a sustainability perspective, the reality is that it sometimes is way easier to just utilize the conventional chemicals, fertilizers, and so on, right? So sustainability is I like to say it's a beautiful concept, but very difficult to apply in reality, because you are basically asking people to compromise their livelihoods to ensure that there's some level of, you know, equity for future generations. And I always say, if you tell a man today, okay, you don't need to do this or do this this way, and you're doing it this way and you're going to lose X amount of productivity, or you realize that your production is decreased, just simply to ensure that future generations have access to these, you know, levels of production and so on, it sounds nice in theory, but it is difficult. Somebody who is trying to make ends meet today and provide for their families and so on, how do you convince them to care about people who may not necessarily even be born yet?
In some countries, and I've heard this complaint coming out more from the European side, where they would say, listen, you are, the state is implementing particular laws and regulations that require me to take certain steps in my operation. I'm going to become more sustainable, but I'm going to become less competitive. You are telling me I need to do this here if I want to produce here, but you are not limiting people who want to import from other places that aren't acting in that certain way, and therefore they would have lower production costs. You are allowing their goods into our countries, but from where we are, what you want us to do, it is going to put us as a disadvantage. You've seen that?
Yeah, that's very, very true. In fact, that was a case, I mean, I can't speak about the details, but essentially I could give a little overview of a situation where, you know, in Caribbean Week of Agriculture, I think it was last year, one of the discussions was, where do we import poultry from? And you know that Jamaica has moved leaps and bounds in terms of their poultry industry. And some countries were seeking to import from outside of the region, Latin America, etc., right? And it was a major concern because obviously they may be able to get it at a lower cost. But at the same time, you have to consider Caribbean circumstances. So it is impossible for any Caribbean island to produce any of the major crops on a large scale and guarantee quality and quantity for a long period of time and at a price that is competitive on the international market because of our individual circumstances, small size, diverse soil types, that sort of thing, right? So essentially what you have just described there is the fact that you are telling local producers to do X, Y, and Z, which limits their productivity, but you are making concessions for international producers to get products into your country, and technically they do what they want. But you realize now, faster export stuff, you have, you know, all these international regulations where you have to now kind of, just now you would have new restrictions put in place for imports into the EU. And these are things that we have to consider, right? And I think it's unfair, and I think it's something that we really need to address on a large scale. And ever since we lost our preferential agreements with the EU and so on, and the European Union back in the day when we had preferential treatment in terms of our ability to export sugar, bananas, cocoa, coffee, it has become a challenge for the agricultural sectors across the region to actually be competitive.
I've seen a trend, I would say largely in the U.S., a pushback against some of the more extreme measures of what is perceived as sustainability. How does the market really decide on a level of maybe accepted damage or what we're willing to allow? Because it feels like on one end, both ends, it's extreme. How do things usually kind of balance out?
The reality is this, right? The current American administration is no longer buying the global rhetoric of climate change and sustainability and that sort of thing. They're about production and productivity and that sort of thing, right? And there must be a balance. I think at the end of the day, when you do things that are deleterious to the environment, eventually it's going to catch up with you. But at the same time, when you don't do those things and you adopt, strict sustainability measures and so on, it increases cost, it decreases production in some cases, and it makes livelihoods more of a challenge. So I believe that naturally the environment will find a way to say, hey, this is enough, right? So usually if we use excessive chemicals, if we use unsustainable techniques, there will eventually be some sort of effect on your productivity as well, which will tell you that, hey, you know what, we can't continue to do this way. We may need to become a little more efficient in terms of how we administer chemicals or the type of chemicals we use. Or if there is water scarcity, you may want to consider using more efficient ways of irrigation. And one of the things we don't really do in the Caribbean is look at crop water requirements. I had a situation where we were discussing with some regional farmers I can't remember the forum, but it was basically, I asked them, how do you decide how much water you give to your crops? And the answer was simply, in many cases, they would go on experience, and some of them will just simply tell you when the soil looks wet. And if you go back to what I explained at the start, you have soils are not necessarily uniform, right? You could have sand at the top, in the top maybe foot of the soil, and then as you go down, you will have some clay, etc. So it may actually look wet at the top, but it's not actually getting to the root zone. It may even look dry at the top, and it may be waterlogged below, right? And different crops have different requirements for water at different times of their growth stages. So in more advanced systems like Israel and so on, for instance, where water scarcity is a big, big issue, they actually mathematically calculate the amount of water that a plant requires at different stages, and they only give it that amount, because any excess water you give to a plant will just, necessarily just evaporate and be lost. Yeah. So I think a balance will be struck inevitably, whenever we do things that are not necessarily the right thing, there will be impacts and consequences, and the consequences will kind of inform what we do in future.
I have a farmhand, and he's age, right? He is probably early 70s. Very experienced, of course, traditional methods of agriculture, untrained. But I bought a moisture meter for soils, and I was showing him how easy it was to use, which was you just stick it in the ground and you take a reading, and I was showing it to him, and he would just laugh and said, you need that. I don't need that, and let me show you. And he'd just stick his finger in the ground and say wet, or tell me dry, right? So I fully understand what you mean, and that some of these solutions are cheap to implement and cheap to check, and I would show him the difference areas of the land and say, okay, this one will probably drain faster. This one wouldn't. These crops need it. Let's just use the meter so you know you're not wasting time and wasting water. But it's generally a lot harder for persons who are in traditional methods to adapt some of these more modern, even though these things are not as modern, but you know, forms of technology that would assist. So, yeah, you're speaking to me there.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, we have to also be cognizant, because many times people speak about new technologies and new things, and I always like to talk about adaptations under climate change. And adaptations is using different techniques and, you know, adapting to the changing environment and so on, right? But it is not easy to do. And it is not something that you can actually just say, hey, do this and you will get better productivity, because it doesn't always work that way. So these farmers, I mean, we have to respect many times. They have, I guess, indigenous and institutional knowledge, if you want to call it that, from working in the sector for quite some time. And unless you can demonstrate to them in a practical and real way that utilizing a certain type of technology or method improves their productivity, it is a very, very hard sell.
For sure. All right. We're going to go to a quick break. We've been talking about sustainability from the part of maybe human actions. But when we get back from the break, I want to talk about disruptions that are beyond our control, what happens naturally. So stay tuned, listeners. We're going to get into this just after a few short commercials. Thank you for joining us. Now, what happens, Dr. countries in the Caribbean? Every single year we see hurricanes and other similar climatic events happening with very limited action of putting preventative steps in place. We know the hurricane season is coming up just now. Do you think that we are proactive in considering that when it comes to sustainable agriculture, or do we just kind of hope and pray?
Well, I think it varies across the region, right? Generally speaking, we are not proactive, right? And most times, this may sound kind of bad, but one of the best ways to get people or society to conform to more resilient strategies and taking warnings and so on seriously is to have had an experience of a disaster. So for instance, if you see what has happened or experience what would have happened in Grenada, right, with Ivan since 2010 or around there, even when you had Beryl and so on, and most recently Melissa, persons who would have experienced these types of disasters, they take warnings, they take advice, and they take, you know, any sort of intervention that can help them very seriously. That is not necessarily true for Trinidad and Tobago, because I think for most people alive now, we have not actually experienced a significant disaster or natural disaster, I would say, right? And we tend to be very, you know, nonchalant about the whole thing. And sometimes you even see, it's very amusing to me at times, like people sometimes seem to be upset when a hurricane or a tropical storm does not hit Trinidad after there was a warning and the Met Office and ODPM and so on say, well, you know, do X, Y, and Z, get X, Y, and Z at your house in order to make sure that you have supplies and so on. And people after it, you know, it naturally wears off in most cases because of the Coriolis force and the deflection of the, that's why the hurricanes always go upwards and somehow seem to bend just before it reaches Trinidad and Tobago, right? And it's almost like people are upset, like, what are we going to do with all these sausages? Why are we going to do with all these candles? You know, it's a very strange dynamic, right? And that's amusing to me in some cases, because I don't think people really understand the devastation that could result from a tropical storm or a hurricane, particularly in countries where, you know, disaster management and risk management is limited. We see what happens in Trinidad when you just have normal or even what we call extreme rainfall at times, and there's significant flooding, which devastates the agricultural sector. And there could be a series of, you know, cascading impacts as a result of that. Another thing that we don't really think about too much is bushfires. In fact, I say that because I actually saw a bushfire from my house yesterday in Maracas, St. Joseph, by Riverside Road there on the hills. And it was very, very bad, and it was starting to get close to where people were living. And I go back to the initial question that you would have asked me about the connection. So when you have bushfires will basically, apart from any sort of physical or infrastructural damage, it causes loss of vegetation. It causes, you know, in some cases you could have soil sealing, which means that the soil is sort of caked up, etc. So there'll be increased rates of runoff. And what that means is that when rain falls in the subsequent, well, the rainy season, there will be increased runoff that will get to your waterways and perhaps increase the potential for flooding. You will also lose fertile topsoil. The ecosystem itself is also negatively affected, because when you lose natural vegetation, it's unlikely that you will have that natural vegetation returning, because you will have the emergence of what we call opportunistic species like shrubs and so on, right, that will grow in its place. So these sorts of hazards, when you talk about hurricanes, bushfires, droughts, they can have long-lasting impacts. And for the most part, Caribbean countries do not take this as seriously as they should.
Yeah, I think one of the arguments for them is that we do have the financial capability of putting protective things in there. Then some will say, listen, how are we going to protect our 20 acres of land from flooding beyond putting certain drains? I mean, I completely understand both sides of it. So then, in Trinidad and Tobago, let's bring it down here, where we are kind of at the lower part of the hurricane belt. We don't generally get hurricanes, so we do get flooding a couple times per year. How at risk do you think we are right now?
You mean the agricultural sector?
Well, I mean, we could, yeah, with the agricultural sector, but we could talk overall from a disaster risk standpoint. I mean, you think we have things in place to deal with such a climatic event?
Well, no, I don't think any Caribbean country has things in place to deal with a Category 4 hurricane or anything above Category 3, right? That being said, many countries have progressed, including Trinidad, in terms of, you know, developing early warning systems. So Trinidad now has through something called the CFUS project, which was a community flood early warning systems project supported by UNDP in collaboration with the ODPM and so on, where in some cases you have stream gauges and so on installed. So you could, I don't know if you noticed, but or maybe the listeners would have noticed, but in the last couple of years, or maybe the last year or so, you started to see river levels as being reported through the Met Office and ODPM. So it tells you like the Carina River is at 90% and so on. This is a step in the right direction, because now you can actually understand, well, okay, it is expected to flood in 10 minutes, and it could save lives in that regard, and perhaps allow people to not venture into those areas. From a food security perspective or agricultural perspective, and even from a domestic perspective, it is very difficult to stop flooding in a sense, right? I think we have gotten to a point, particularly in Trinidad, where flooding is no longer a problem to be solved, but rather a reality to which we must adapt. And you have seen that in some cases where, you know, places that consistently flood, people have actually adjusted their lifestyle. They would change the structure of their house to ensure that it's on stilts. They would probably build little embankments. They've increased the height of their foundation. I actually saw a situation where an old woman had some issues with flooding all the time, and we had visited her to kind of assess the situation. And she basically told me that I'm so accustomed to flooding during the rainy season that I basically built all my cupboards in concrete. I have a counter that I, you know, when rain starts to fall, I just take everything that is important and put it there. I allow the water to flow through, and I have adapted to that circumstance. So I think we are very at risk if there is a severe hurricane that impacts Trinidad and Tobago. And it's not just about these, you know, conventional events. You have other things, like drought is something we don't really take too seriously because it's sort of insidious and it takes a long time to you know, see the final impacts, and it's not an acute event like a hurricane. Bushfires, as I mentioned before, is a big issue. And we tend to focus a lot on flooding and compensation rather than and what you call flood relief grants and that sort of thing. But we are not necessarily putting in the background work to minimize the potential impacts. And by that, I mean, you know, town and country planning approvals where we build. A lot of the issues in the foothills of the Northern Range is because of all the development that is happening uphill. There are places that flood now that never flooded before. There are places where you'll see people complaining all the time, hey, you know what, there's so much rain, but the dams are empty. And why is that so? Because at the time the dams were designed, the watershed dynamics were entirely different. Because of our developmental profile over time, we have altered the manner in which the water flows. So it's not going to the dam as it would have usually done in the past. I think that's about it for that question.
I sometimes I sit down and I ask myself the question, if you knew that this area flooded, why did you set up your operation or your house in that area? And then where I live, it is surrounded by a lot of nothing, right? Grass, bush, acres all around. And then industries started setting up, slowly coming closer and closer. A lot of concrete, and I started to understand how things change over time. Developments change over time, changing how water, surface water is handled, runs off in certain areas. And I said, and I think, you know, 10, 15 years, if it truly becomes developed all around me, I could potentially be at risk for something like that. So sometimes I guess they don't start off, but they end up in that position. And as you said, places that never used to flood sometimes start to flood after a while.
Yep. And the funny part is you will find persons blaming these things. And I want to say this because almost everything that happens in a natural environment for the last 20 years, everybody says is climate change and changing climate and unprecedented rainfall and things like that. I just think it's important for us to recognize that you could have the same amount of rain today with the same intensity today that you would have had 30 years ago, and the impacts are entirely different. So it cannot and is not just a changing climate. We have to accept some responsibility for the impacts and consequences that we face today. It is not just you're getting, you know, excessive rainfall and that alone. Yeah?
Oh, boy. I guess I can definitely see some of these issues plaguing us consistently for a long time, and even the water distribution. I had a conversation with some persons who are involved in the infrastructure and was trying to understand why some areas would get supplies a lot different from other areas. And one of the explanations really was, listen, when the original infrastructure was designed, we didn't cater for all these housing developments and so along the way. It wasn't really designed for this. And when we continuously added developments everywhere without adapting the supply infrastructure sufficiently, that started to create a problem that we are now trying to address. And I guess it is still going to take them some time. It is still going to require a lot of money to do it. As where I have a farm and where I have a business space, we get water every 14 days. But where I live, I get water almost every single day. So, you know, it is quite a difference, I guess, depending on where you are.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it is based on, you know, development happened over time, and the other, the supporting factors to ensure that the development is properly serviced didn't happen at the same time. So, and it's also an issue in terms of how we are governed, right? So I will say this, the last administration was very focused on increasing, you know, like things like wastewater reuse, for instance. Trinidad developed a wastewater reuse standard where persons can actually utilize treated wastewater for agricultural and landscaping uses in 2024, I think. Yeah, I may be wrong about the year, but it was, it was developed in the last couple of years, right? And the idea behind that was we had all these wastewater treatment plants across the country, and it was supposed to supplement the supply of water for agricultural uses. And many times you don't need to treat the water to the same level of the water pollution rules, for instance. So even, and then, well, potable water, of course, because some of the, you know, the nutrients within treated wastewater will actually be beneficial for agriculture. And you know what the major challenge was after you had all these, you know, developing a standard and so on, was actually accessing the water. Because where the treatment plants are, the wastewater treatment plants are, they are very, I guess, distant from most of the agricultural districts. And you would have to spend a significant amount of money to put infrastructure to get it there, which is why I go back to my initial point about the manner in which our agricultural sector evolved over time. Having established areas for agriculture is essential, because then you can develop all the associated systems around it to support meaningful production. But as it stands, you have, you know, random farms all over the country, and it's very, very difficult for infrastructural development and costly to facilitate, you know, proper servicing. And you see now the focus has sort of shifted from wastewater reuse, where this new administration is more focused on desal and so on to increase water supply. And one of the biggest issues is not just the fact that we are just, this is just a random fact, we are one of the countries that has one of the largest consumption rates, or the greatest in consumption rates in the region in terms of water, right? And that is because of two things. One, we hardly pay anything for water in terms of the cost. And then we also have what we call a high level of non-revenue water. Non-revenue water is water that you cannot, you don't bill people for, because you don't know where it's going. That's because of like leaks and so on, illegal abstraction and things like that. So about 50%, and this is just random figures, but close enough to reality. Over 50% of the water that is produced by Wasa, we don't know where it goes.
I did not know it's so high.
It is probably higher than that in reality, because you can't actually know the real value. And I'll tell you why again, because we don't have domestic metering. So you can have a car wash, Judy, and using water as much as you want. And I could be saving every drop, and we both pay the same rate.
Why is it that on your private property, if you wanted to dig a well, that would not be allowed? Or without maybe permits, I guess. Why is that not something?
Well, I mean, that I agree with, because you can't have everybody trying to dig a well or build a pond and that sort of thing, because that falls under the remit of the Water Resources Agency. They are supposed to assess our water resources. And you can't, like, you know, if you have extreme or too much abstraction from wells and so on, it could lead to salinization of soils and contamination of groundwater supplies and that sort of thing. So it should be something that is regulated, right? And remember, as a country, if you have all your water resources and you have a proper assessment, you know how much water you have in terms of groundwater and the expected amount of rain and so on in terms of replenishment, you sort of manage your distribution accordingly, right? So it is something that is important, in my opinion, that there is some level of oversight and regulations with respect to people building, well, digging ponds and, you know, trying to access water through wells and so on. And I just remembered something. You would also have people doing things that they shouldn't do. A couple of years ago, I think in 2017, there was a fair amount of flooding in Aranguez region. And when some analysis was done, it was basically an individual who would have made some adjustments to the riverbank to facilitate getting water to his farms. And these are things that, you know, we are very, very lackadaisical about. And sometimes the actions of one person to facilitate their requirements has impacts on hundreds of other people when you face the consequences of something like extreme rainfall, which leads to severe flooding and so on.
Wow. Okay. So, Doc, we kind of coming towards the end of this program. I want to ask you something quickly. We often hear in all these big forums with all the heads from around the world, the supposed to be the brightest of the brightest, talk about climate financing. What really is that?
Right. So every country that signs on to, I don't know if the listeners will be familiar, but you don't have these multilateral international agreements, right? Like the SDGs, the Paris Agreement, and that sort of thing. What that means is that we are all committed to addressing the issues of climate change and sustainable development. Trinidad is signatory to most of these multilateral agreements. And as part of that, you are supposed to put things in place to reduce or mitigate climate change, right? The things in place are like certain activities where you promote water use efficiency, you reduce your carbon footprint, provide incentives for people to switch from conventional petrol cars to electric cars, that sort of thing, right? Those are like methods that could address or minimize the impact or our contribution to climate change. Now, every country has to do something called a nationally determined contribution. What that means is you will outline plans for specific sectors where you would put measures in place to reduce your, to make it simple, your carbon emissions, right? Trinidad kind of focuses on the transportation sector, but the last NDC was submitted under the last administration. So I'm not sure what will happen with the new administration if their focus would be a little bit different and so on. But they kind of focus on the transportation sector. And that is why you had the introduction of electric vehicles and the taxes and so on were less, right? And that being said, these NDCs, what we consider them for developing countries like ourselves is called conditional NDCs. Conditional really means that, yeah, you would do things at a national level, but you will only be able to achieve the full potential of your nationally determined contributions if you are provided with supporting finance from the developed world. And that finance comes from like agencies like the Global Environmental Facility, GEF, the Adaptation Fund, and developmental organizations like UNDP and so on, right? So it's basically a document that outlines the plans of a country. And in many cases, Caribbean countries or developing countries submit what we call conditional NDCs. So it's contingent on the fact that we can only really do this if we receive the climate financing. I don't know if you would have been familiar with the Abbas agenda, which took place in SIDS 4 in Antigua and Barbuda, maybe 2 years ago. And part of that was to ensure that, you know, all these things where it costs our loss and damage fund and establishing a fund for Caribbean islands or developing worlds, the developing world to be able to access is a lot of, is basically developed countries contributing to a fund to assist the developing world in building their climate resilience. But as the former prime minister of SVG would have said, when you examine the nature of these funds and these agreements, a lot of these things are, again, old talk. They have commitment to provide funding, but when you look at the balance in the accounts and how much is actually there, it is not even sufficient to help one Caribbean country recover from a hurricane.
So it's that the money actually does not come in?
Well, they say they put commitment. It's not a commitment doesn't necessarily mean that they put it, you know?
I understand. So, I mean, do we access in Trinidad climate financing in any way?
Yeah. A lot of the, for instance, when you look at IDB, some of the projects that I mentioned before, like the CFUs, we are currently in the process of developing a multi-hazard disaster management policy, right? All of these things are supported for the most part by external agencies, which in many cases are funded through the Global Environmental Facility or the Adaptation Fund or things like the IDB, developmental loans and so on. And I'm not sure, again, if this was general public knowledge, but under the previous administration, Trinidad and Tobago would have accessed a fairly sizable IDB loan to improve water use efficiency, to install some level of metering, and so on.
That I did not know. So, I mean, let me ask you one more question. A lot of these things we discussed to implement takes time. This is not a sector that you can do things overnight. It takes planning, implementation, and then a while to see what happens. However, electoral cycles are generally 5 years. Is there anything we can do to maybe help bridge that gap so that actions and activities last a little bit longer?
When I say we, who is the we you're referring to?
Well, you know, if it's something that is at the government level, or I don't know, because we all always see things being implemented and then cancelled when new administrations come in.
Well, I have a serious issue with that. I feel like we make two steps forward, then we make two steps back, then we make two steps forward, then we make two steps back, and we're really not going anywhere, right? And it is something that bothers me because, you know, not everything that every administration does would be good, but not everything that they do would also be bad. And I think that's political immaturity in a sense, where any sort of new administration that comes in somehow chastises all the activities of the previous and vice versa, right? Now, from an agricultural perspective, I do not think that Trinidad and Tobago has, any administration has seriously taken agriculture forward. There have been some steps in certain directions and so on, but I think, as we say in Trinidad, we just spin in top in mud. To really have progress, we need administrations to be serious about developing the sector. I often say that I want to get to a point where a farmer could receive the same amount of respect as an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer. I also want to see that the sector itself is formalized so that we have, I mean, it's very difficult, as you say, for an individual farmer to invest in all the modern technology to increase his efficiency and have sustainable agriculture and all these different practices in place. However, if you champion that through the state, where the state basically, you know, has agricultural districts where they set up all the necessary infrastructure, they provide all the inputs, etc. All the farmers are actually doing is working, planting, tending to the crops or the livestock, etc. And we have a national drive towards increasing productivity that is supported by the ministry, and farmers and people working in the agricultural sector have some level of job security and, you know, provided with all the inputs. And we look at it more from a national perspective rather than providing a little grant and, you know, a little bit of a tractor and this sort of thing. I don't think we will make much progress. What is happening now, and I think you may have noticed this as well, many persons who are already affluent in society, who are in other types of businesses, maybe manufacturing and other things, have started to venture into the agricultural sector because they recognize that it can be profitable. And I go back to the same point that I made at the start. In terms of increasing national production, we are talking about it. We are saying that we should do it, etc. But there are sectors of society that are not necessarily inclined to support increasing in local production and reducing imports because they benefit. That is part of their structure. And with that being said, I'm not saying we should not import at all. What I'm saying is increasing production locally does not necessarily mean a reduction in import. If you could produce enough locally where we can also export, it therefore means that we could gain forex and it could sort of balance off in a way, right? We have, you know, tropical fruits and vegetables and so on are some of the most nutritious and the most sought after in the world, but we don't necessarily market our things as properly as we should. We don't have the sector developed as well as it should, where we could guarantee on an international market quality and quantity. So for me, there needs to be a massive drive towards formalizing the agricultural sector, and the support that the sector needs should be provided, and not just in an ad hoc, by the way, manner where you do a little pilot here and a pilot there and you make it seem like, you know, you're supporting the sector itself.
Doc, I want to thank you so much for your impact. It's been such a wonderful conversation. It's not a topic that we do very often. It's not a topic that is considered quite often when you think about the sector, but I believe that the listeners would have loved what we spoke about. And to our listeners, if you want to get a recap of this interview, usually it's uploaded on the Freedom 106.5 FM's website under podcasts. Doc, thank you so much. This brings the end of our conversation. You have any closing remarks for the listeners?
No problem. And, you know, thanks for inviting me. I hope that we could continue to do some more of this as we go along. And just by the way, since we were talking of the topic of disaster risk management, the Trinidad and Tobago will have a disaster risk management conference in June, from June 1st to 3rd in Hyatt. And it's basically supported by, you know, the ministry. It also has the TTDRM group that will be part of it. And persons can check it out. There's a website that they could visit. They could just type in Trinidad and Tobago Disaster Risk Management Conference, and they should be able to access all the information regarding the conference itself. And it's perhaps something that, you know, persons may be interested in attending.
Wonderful. It sounds excellent. Okay, listeners, that's it for us. Thank you so much for joining us. Of course, next week I will be here Thursday, 10 o'clock. New guest, new topic. Thanks so much, Tuskers. Back on to you.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.